Dublin's Talking Sport.
Welcome to Dublin's Talking Sports podcast with me, Ken Doherty, and my good friend, Reggie Corrigan. Thanks for tuning in to catch up on the latest GAA, football, rugby, and all the crack. Enjoy the show, and don't forget, rate and review wherever you get your podcasts.
Morning, Ken. How are you?
Good morning, Reg. How are you?
I'm not too bad, but I have to tell you, Ken, I had an accident yesterday, and it's an embarrassing one. I was playing golf, and I went down like an owl, lad. I hit the deck. I slipped going down a hill on the 8th in Druids, and underfoot, and my foot went out from underneath me. And you know, you're getting old when you can't manage to adjust your body
to get up
enough to fall in a kind of a normal way. I fell the most awkward way, and I can barely walk on my knee this morning. But
oh, you're a joke.
But anyway, we get through it.
Well, this is what happens when you keep knocking in boardies, you know, to the surprise of everybody.
I tell you, I was going well as well. It was really sickening. And the two lads I was with, fair play to them, they didn't laugh. And they managed to keep the laughter in when I hit the deck. But there was some choice language out of them when they tried to lift me up because I needed them to try and give me a bit of a lift. So
yeah.
It was a good workout for them. I put it to you.
You know what they say. Well, it's all downhill from here, Reg. You know?
Going downhill was the problem. I wasn't looking where it was going. Slippy underfoot at the moment. I need to get the spikes out. You know the old spikes we used to be able to get from
The old spikes. Yeah. Remember those? Yeah, you don't see them around anymore, do you?
I might get the football boots out, actually, the old 18mm steel studs. I don't know if the greenskeeper would be too happy, but they'd be the
ones. No, I don't think so.
Anyway, your lads could have done with some of that last week, a few 18mm studs.
Oh, my God.
You were bragging about going to that Old Trafford match.
I couldn't wait to go. I was standing behind the goal in the Stretford End. I got great seats. You know, it was great singing, great atmosphere going around. And, of course, I saw all the four goals into that goal as well. Salah was amazing. United were embarrassing. And Salah and Firmino and Jota, the front three, were just incredible on fire. It was great. I mean, you know, it wasn't great to see. It was terrible. I mean, it was probably one of the worst matches I was at as a Manchester United fan, if not the worst, I think. But at the same time, the quality of Liverpool is, you know, when you see it live, and particularly Salah, I mean, what an amazing player. Amazing player.
Incredible, yeah. No, it was a beautiful performance from them, all right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I got to give credit where it's due. It was class is the only way to describe it. They just look like a team.
Yeah.
With a great flow to them, and worthy title contenders at this early stage in the season.
Yeah.
But I suppose we have to talk about United. I mean, being there, you know, being such a fan as you are, and having the inside track a little bit, because I know Alex looks after you well there too, and you're up in the kind of upper echelons, mixing with, you know, the people that would have something to say. Like, what's the mood and what's the feeling and what's going on? Like,
I think the mood is like he's now. I don't think he's gone yet, but I think these next three matches are gonna probably be his destiny. You know, to stay at the club or not. You know, because if they go out today and lose, and then of course they've got the Champions League during the week, and then of course the arrival of City to Old Trafford. I mean, that could be just as embarrassing unless they change. I mean, last Sunday, the difference between the two teams is how they passed the ball, Liverpool, how quick they were. And, of course, their formation as well. You know, the way they were set up and the way they attacked the ball, the way they pressed the ball, the front three all the time. Ours weren't doing that, you know, leaving so many gaps. And there was just completely disjointed between the two teams. Now, the Man United fans, they still love Ollie because of what he's done to the club, but it's starting to wear a little bit. Same now, you would say, you know, because they were so like that doesn't happen at Old Trafford losing the 5-0 to Liverpool, your biggest rivals, you know.
Absolutely not. But the thing is, it's gone viral, obviously, the Paul Scholes piece where he was predicting that this is gonna happen. Like, I mean, it seems to be that everyone else can see it except Ole or maybe I'm wrong, but you know,
well, maybe if it's like, well, Reggie, you know about playing in teams. Now, it probably never happened when you played for Leinster, but there's some players on that team that aren't working like the rest of them are, you know, and that creates a big, big problem, you know.
If you believe any of the rumours
in the papers about some of the players that don't have faith in Ollie, you can actually see that on the pitch, you know? So that's exactly what happens, you know?
But on that point, though, right? I mean, it's a valid point. So, yes, I would have played in teams in Leinster and Ireland where there would have been superstar players. But there was never anyone that got above their station because the players dragged them back down. It wasn't down to a manager. There was no coach involved in that. Yeah. Nobody ever let anybody get above themselves. Or like almost an Irish thing. It'll happen across all sports in Ireland.
Of course, you know,
someone gets kind of too big for their boots. They're dragged down pretty quick.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So, like, well, you can see, I don't know whether...
The pressure should be on, or the responsibility should be on the United players to make that happen, you know?
Yeah. I think, I don't know. I mean, you look at Pogba, he came on, got caught with the ball, then sort of, you know, gave it 2 foot tackle, he's out. Now he's out for the next 3 games. It's stupid things like that are happening. And I don't know. I mean... Watching the two teams, you could see there was no confidence in the United team at all. And when that happens, that comes from above. Like, obviously, so it's coming down from the manager and the coaching staff. Mm-hmm. So, and even though, and Paul Scholes is totally right, even though, you know, there was a last-minute winner against the Villarreal and Atlanta, you know, the warning signs were there, you know, about how much possession, the leaking goals all the time. But against Liverpool, I've never seen it that bad, to be honest.
But no manager could come in and manage Pogba the way he is. He's not like he has to go. And I mean, he is you can spot disruptive influences, and he's definitely one. And like his teammates don't seem to, and he's playing rubbish. Great when he plays for France, but he's playing rubbish for United.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It seems to me that even if they got rid of Ole. I just don't know what manager could come in there and sort that out with the current squad that they have. They'd have to cut a lot of people and bring in some different figures.
Yeah, they would do. Yeah, there's a big, it'd be interesting to see what happens in January. Are they going to buy any players or whatever? But the interesting is just see how it goes today. I mean, I'm going to the match today. I've got a ticket for the Tottenham game today.
Are you sure now? I think Alex is going to be kind of like,
My friend texted me the other day. He says, you're a glutton for punishment.
But also, you're a bit of a bad luck charm for them as well.
I know. Oh, well, look, I mean, I just love going to the games. I mean, I couldn't leave even. You know, a lot of the United fans had left and all, but a lot of them stayed back and started singing, and I can't do that. But I'm looking forward to seeing the game today and see a different, although I'll be in the Tottenham end, so that's got to be a bit worrying.
Yeah,
you might see me carted out, you know, with like 4 bouncers, you know, in high-vis jackets, you know.
And what's the mood amongst the ordinary fan over there? I mean, you know, you're seeing them and some are leaving.
The pictures
on Sky are pretty harrowing to watch, you know, the upset on their faces. What's the mood like with them?
As I said, the mood is like they love Ollie, but as I said, they're sort of losing a little bit of faith. They were still shouting his name, you know, at the end of the match. There's no doubt about that. But I think even, you know, the average supporter can see the style and the way they play, what they're giving up possession, and you know they're just not playing as a team, you know, and that's very, very worrying, you know.
Okay, it's time to turn our attention to rugby now. Delighted to be joined on the line by Will Slattery of the Irish Independent and of course the Left Wing podcast. Good morning, Will, how are you?
Good, thanks, Reggie. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Very well indeed. Looking forward to a cracking match later on today. We'll get to that in a few minutes, of course, when Wales take on the New Zealand All Blacks. Before we get to the Autumn Internationals and Andy Farrell's choices and how Ireland might fare, an interesting piece during the week came to light with Caelan Doris and his struggles with concussion. And, you know, it was an enlightening piece in many ways, Will, because we don't normally get players coming out and openly talking about these things and maybe admitting that they've had these types of injuries. So it was very interesting to see.
Yeah, very interesting, as you say, Reggie. And fair play to Caelan Doris for having the honesty to speak about it, because it was a fairly uncomfortable topic, I'd imagine, for him to go back over. Like, for a bit of context for people listening, you know, he made his debut for Ireland against Scotland in the first match of the Andy Farrell era in the Six Nations just before COVID. He got a very bad concussion after about 2 minutes there. And then subsequently, when we came back after COVID, he suffered another concussion in a European game. And then in a training match in the build-up to the 2021 Six Nations, he got another head knock. And then, interestingly, it was him himself who decided maybe to take a step back and say, and maybe seek expert advice and expert treatment. He said he had maybe some difficulties remembering names and a few other little details like that. So it was a scary window into, what a player can go through, especially someone so young and with their whole career ahead of you. It's a kind of a stark reminder of some of the, I suppose, the dangers facing the sport. But I suppose from a positive point of view, he got the help, he got the assessment, he took the time off, and now he's come back and he's playing good rugby again. It's a good case study for players and maybe for the sport generally, that, you know, maybe taking that little bit of time out and assessing things for over a longer period. We've seen it with Johnny Sexton before, and he's been able to come back, like, even over the summer, he took the time away. So, yeah, it was a very interesting piece. I'd encourage everyone who hasn't read it to give it a read, because it's a really good insight into what players actually go through and how they can get back on the pitch.
Can't imagine the air if you were too happy about him coming out so openly discussing it. It doesn't.
Yeah, well, like, I don't think he was pointing any fingers, to be fair. Like, I think it was just about his journey. And, you know, I think, you know, he was put up for a media day. I don't think he'd done any since that. He'd been back. So I'd say they had a good idea what would be asked or what he might talk about. So I'd actually imagine that it was probably a degree of collaboration to a certain extent, because it was obvious once he was flagged as the media participant that it was likely that this was going to be discussed. So you don't know what's going on behind closed doors, but I wouldn't be surprised if it had been discussed that maybe this would be a good opportunity to maybe talk a bit about it. But it's hard to know these things, I suppose.
Interesting. Good for him to show that the topic is still very much to the fore and being managed and discussed. Okay, let's have a look at the Autumn Internationals. Andy Farrell, a man who's probably under a large degree of pressure, I would say, to try and deliver now at this stage. There's been the COVID interruptions, there's been all of the various different bits and pieces, but he's picked an interesting squad, is how I'd describe it. Certainly there seems to be an eye to the future in there in certain areas, but in others maybe not so. What did you make of it all?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Like, as you say, there's a couple of young guys in there who don't have that much experience. But by and large, it's going to be a fairly familiar team. Like, I expect it to be pretty similar to the team that played against England at the end of the Six Nations, which was the signature victory of Andy Farrell's reign. And it kind of leads into a very interesting autumn where, like, I'm very intrigued to see the team that comes out. Is it the team that played and beat England in terms of the performance levels that we probably haven't seen since the highlights of the Joe Schmidt era? Or is it the team for the first probably 7 or 8 matches of his reign, which was quite uninspired and a fairly conservative selection? Like, I expect it to be a selection we're all very familiar with for the Japan and New Zealand game. I don't expect any kind of bolters or players like maybe Robert Balakoon or Dan Sheehan to be involved in those games. Actually, I think the only kind of maybe selection dilemmas are maybe the back three and, to a lesser extent, maybe the back row, depending on what options he likes to go with. But then the rest of the team, I think, probably picks itself, which in some ways you can look at it and say it's a positive, because some of these guys are world-class and they're playing well. But on the other hand, you would like maybe a few more new options putting their hand up, because some of these guys haven't played a lot of rugby. They're not in maybe great form either. So it's an interesting couple of weeks for him, because he doesn't have that much time to experiment.
Yeah, I mean, the one obvious area that people are going to look at is the 9-10 combination, how that might look. You know, we know it's going to be Johnny Sexton, but in terms of the future, you know, he obviously isn't going to blood anyone that's going to. I just don't know how it's going to go. Like, I mean, it's got to be Johnny Sexton for the All Blacks match. You'd imagine, as you said, for the Japanese game, to get some run into that All Blacks match, they're going to have to go with Sexton as well. So Argentina's not going to be any walk in the park either. So where's the room for experiment?
Yeah, it's funny when you look at out half. Like, say if this was the out half situation in, like, England, we'd be looking on and we'd be kind of laughing with dismay, being like, how are they going into another World Cup in an almost identical position as the last two, whereby Johnny Sexton was the main man and the understudies have played very limited amounts of rugby in meaningful international games? So, like, Joey Carberry's in the squad. Obviously, everyone knows how much potential he has, and he was playing really well before that long run of injuries, but he's been playing very poorly this season. Harry Byrne, again, a lot of potential, but he picked up niggly injuries at just the wrong time when he's about to get a bit of a break. So they're the two guys that are in there. And then you have Jack Carty, a guy, to be fair, is playing very well, but I think people maybe, and Andy Farrell seems to have this view, has maybe a ceiling when it comes to maybe being an international out half. And the other options haven't really taken their chances either. So we're left in a very, I wouldn't say maybe unusual, but definitely not an ideal position at the most important position. And as you say, the Argentina game is the only real room for experimentation. But if what happens if you know, they don't play well against Japan. They got beaten badly by the All Blacks. Will he really want to then, you know, ring the changes for a game that he'll probably need to win to get a bit of momentum? So it's a fascinating period, as you say. And then after that, we have the Six Nations and a 3-test tour to New Zealand in the summer, which that's no place to be blooding rookies either. So there's not that many matches. Maybe Italy in the Six Nations, potentially Argentina. They're the only two real opportunities he has to maybe give game time to maybe some of these guys that we do need to expose if we're going to be competitive or be more competitive at the World Cup.
Okay, here's one for you. Of late, and we've done it already ourselves this morning, we tend to place our focus on the backs and on that 9-10 combination and where Ireland's attacking threat will come from. And in recent years, for me anyway, I feel we've lost a lot of our attacking threat in our pack, in our forward combination. And I think that's we're missing a trick there, and we need to go back to that. So that brings into to call the back row decision and second row decision in many ways as well. Now, if you look at the likes of New Zealand, Australia have started to do it as well, and dare I say it, Leinster as well. You're talking about ball playing, ball handling forwards who are as much a part of the attacking play as any backline is. Ireland's recent years have sort of lost that a little bit. You know, there's a bit more drudgery about what they do, a bit more hitting it up, a bit more pick and go around the side instead of being ball players. Does he need to go and pick a younger, more agile back row and forward pack that maybe are ball players as opposed to being mullockers?
Yeah, well, one area that I think could be a real game changer, and you actually didn't touch on it there, is the front row. Like moving Porter to Loosehead and having a front row of Porter, Kelleher and Furlong, I think gives Ireland potentially a massive point of difference to pretty much any other international team, by maybe New Zealand in their at their pomp. All those guys can handle the ball. All those guys are great carriers of the ball. They're very explosive. Like Keen Healy has been an unbelievable player, but at this stage, he's going to be 34. He doesn't maybe have that ball-carrying explosiveness that if you paired Porter in there with the two lads, I think could be really dangerous for Ireland. And I agree, the back row was a fascinating selection. Like Caelan Doris, as we mentioned at the start, was probably the number eight that Andy Farrell favoured the most. But then Jack Conan came in and had a storming season. The number seven position is interesting. Like Josh Van der Vleer is probably the guy there at the moment, but as you say, he doesn't really fit the mold of what you kind of asked me there. The guy who probably does is Dan Levy. Now, he's still very much working his way back to full fitness, but even that lovely touch he showed in the Glasgow game in the build-up to the first try there last week, kind of a side-door offload, that's the kind of pass that not many other Irish back rows would throw. So if he can get a couple of games, that's why it's so frustrating from a Leinster perspective that they don't have as many matches in the league as they ordinarily would, because this November period would have been an ideal time to get Dan Levy back up to speed ahead of a very important Christmas period. But they don't really have that, so they're kind of missing a bit of a trick there. But if you bring Dan Levy potentially back at full fitness into that back row and have Caelan Doris and Jack Conan at 6 and 8, and then you have that dynamic front row, the picture, I think, changes quite considerably if those guys are all going well and firing. The second row is an interesting one. James Ryan and Henderson are probably in the box seat. I think James Ryan has been struggling for form for quite a while now. Ryan Baird, you know, he didn't play very well against Glasgow, but is a coming force. And he's a guy who actually is very mobile and dynamic too. So there are some options. But as you say, it's about what combinations Farrell will go with. And he does tend to go with the more cautious selection, I think. So I'm hoping to see the Porter, Furlong, Kelleher front row in the autumn. The other guys will have to wait for, you know, a bit of form and fitness to fall into place. But I think there are some options there.
What kind of pressure do you think Andy Farrell is under with this autumn series if it doesn't go well? I mean, it's a tough ask to beat the New Zealand team. We know that we'll expect to beat Japan, but Argentina are no slouches at all.
Yeah, well, I really think that England game at the end of the Six Nations bought him a lot of breathing room, because not only was it a big victory against England, the performance was so impressive. It was up there with the great performances of the Schmidt era. So I think he's got himself a bit of wiggle room, certainly between, like, obviously, if they go out and they struggle against Japan and get hammered by the All Blacks and then struggle against Argentina or lose to Argentina, he'll be back under the firing line. But then you're also at the point where it's quite late in a cycle to make a change. So I think things would have to go catastrophically wrong for him for some change to be made. And I think the England game was a step in the right direction. That's why I'm so intrigued to see if they can back it up in the autumn, because, you know, one of the problems with under Andy Farrell so far has been a bit of consistency. Like, they beat Wales quite well in the Autumn Nations Cup, and the following week they went to Twickenham and they were very badly beaten, not in the scoreboard, but in terms of being in the game. So I don't think he's under quite as much pressure as he was prior to the England game. If that hadn't gone as well, he'd be really under the pump now. I think he's bought himself a bit of wiggle room, but it's very important to see progression here, and certainly the consistency that they showed, maybe taking that England performance and playing it out. I don't think people are really expecting them to beat the All Blacks, but if they get two victories against Japan and Argentina and play pretty well against New Zealand and run them quite close, I think that'll be seen as a reasonably positive window.
Okay, I think that's a fair assessment of it. All right. Okay, you mentioned Wales there. The team that I find the most puzzling throughout the whole of my life. You never know what you're going to get with Wales. They're a phenomenal team at international level. So poor in the domestic situation that they have going on over there. The performances from their domestic teams in the URC always kind of leave something wanting. But they managed to pull it together when it comes to international level, with at times what you might say are somewhat average players compared to what maybe the rest of the world might have on offer at that time. But they always get these amazing results and they put in these incredible performances, and they're one of the most difficult teams that you could ever play against. So there's a cracking match coming up today with New Zealand at 5:15. But again, there's some interesting selection choices there in the Welsh side.
Yeah, it's funny on Wales and the enigma they are. I was at a table quiz the other night, and one of the questions was you have to rank the world ranking teams from 1 to 10. And you honestly, I thought we could have slotted Wales anywhere from like 3 to 9. They actually ended up being 9th. So I thought it was funny enough because they'd won the Six Nations. But it kind of sums up where they are. As you say, they can just pull these international performances out of nowhere. Now, they're really up against it today because a combination of injuries and this game being outside the window, which denies them the ability to select the guys based in England, means I think they're 28-point underdogs against an All Blacks team who look to have been finding their form towards the end of the Rugby Championship. I know they were beaten by South Africa, but they beat them the week before, and they look to be, you know, slowly finding their momentum after maybe a tough first year for Ian Foster. Wales is a really funny one. You know, I just can't really get a read on them. As you say there, we would look at their team sometimes and think we should be beating these guys, you know, 3 times out of 4, 4 times out of 5, but it just hasn't materialised. Like, even like the Ireland's record in Cardiff is very, very poor. Like, I don't expect them to win against New Zealand today, and they'd be doing well if they even came close, but that wouldn't rule them out going on another run in the Six Nations. Like, their Six Nations win last year was probably the most improbable one that I've seen since I started watching rugby. They were probably, people were tipping them to finish last outside of Italy, and they ended up going on a run, obviously getting a bit of fortune with their two red cards, but then they really grew into it. And obviously Wales in a lion's ear is a different animal because the lads all love getting on those tours. But yeah, they're a funny one. I'd be very surprised if they won today. Like, even like Bradley Roberts, the Ulster sub hooker, got called up yesterday into the squad. Like, that's just, I was scratching my head when I saw that. Like, I've seen Ulster a good few times this season, and I thought he's been quite poor, to be honest with you. Yeah. And then he just said parachuted into the Welsh national squad. And it's funny, and obviously Gareth Anscombe back at 10, it's a good story. He's been injured for a long time playing against his native country. So there's a lot of kind of question marks there about the team selection. I'll be interested to see how they go, but I'm expecting a fairly comprehensive New Zealand win.
I'd say I am as well. Like, when you look at that New Zealand team, my God, I know they put 104 points on the US last week. We don't read too much into that, but there's so much talent across that New Zealand team. When you look, like, I mean, there isn't a weak link anywhere in that whole 1 to 15.
No, for sure. Like, it's interesting. Bolden Barrett has kind of been on ice since the World Cup. I think he spent a bit of time in Japan, and now he was playing a bit against South Africa, and I didn't think he looked quite as sharp. They have a bit of a battle, kind of an O'Gara Sexton-esque battle going on at the moment between Mwonga and Bolden Barrett, like the veteran and maybe the younger guy, because they're both very, very good players. Bolden Barrett's winning his 100th cap today. He's only, I think, 30 years old. It shows how important he's been over the last few years. But there's kind of a bit of an identity, not crisis, but in terms of, like, they're two different kind of players. You play kind of two slightly different ways. Mwonga is a little bit looser, and like with fullback kind of nailed down by Jordy Barrett at the moment. Like, they tried the 10-15 experiment at the World Cup, it didn't really work that well. So that's one massive selection decision. You very rarely have seen New Zealand kind of, you know, struggling to select a team because they have so many good players who are usually pretty interchangeable. But that's a really interesting one, I think, to look out for as we move towards the World Cup. Will Ian Foster go with the younger guy who's been tearing up trees at the Crusaders, or will he stick with Bolden Barrett, one of the great players of the last 5-6 years? So it'll be interesting to see today who kind of gets off in the front foot first.
GAA with Declan Drake on Dublin's Talking Sport.
Firstly, this morning we must congratulate Lucan Sarsfields on their quarter-final win over defending county senior football champions Ballymun Kickhams last Saturday. That's a win that earns them a semi-final date against St Jude's, who earlier in the day had been winners over Thomas Davis. Then to Sunday, and victories for Ballyboden St Enda's and Kilmacud Crokes in the last eight over Castleknock and Nafina, respectively. The semi-final draw has pitted Bowden with Crokes. On to ladies football, and congratulations as well to Foxrock Cabinteely, Dublin senior football champions for the seventh consecutive year. They beat Nafina 1-7 to 7 points under the lights at Parnell Park last night. Katie McNally with the key score, that goal 5 minutes from time. We turn our attention on the programme now to hurling, and a massive day tomorrow at county headquarters, with the semi-finals of the go-ahead Dublin Senior A Hurling Championship down for a decision. First up in a very attractive double-header at 1:30 is the meeting of Nafina and Lucan Sarsfields, and that will be followed at 3:45 by the clash of defending champions Coola and Kilmacud Crokes. Joining me now to have a look ahead to these games is our regular hurling analyst, Sean Lane. And Sean, no doubt, like a lot of hurling aficionados in the county, you're really looking forward to what should be a fine afternoon's hurling in Parnell Park tomorrow.
Absolutely, Declan. I can tell you, we'll have the breakfast early at home and be heading over, I hope, to get across to Parnell for two ding-dongers of games about 1:10. So really looking forward to them.
OK, well, first up is Luke and Sarsfields versus Nafina. Now, the Moby Road men, of course, as we know, were Division 1 league winners this year. And Sars, as we've mentioned in the programme before, have been knocking at the door for a number of years now and are back once again. I suppose, if you keep knocking at the door, it's eventually going to open. But what did you make of the performances of both teams in their respective quarter-final victories, Sean?
Yeah, I suppose, Declan, let's look at Lucan first. I mean, Lucan have probably have had the harder route to the semi-final. You know, I'll get to the last game against the Crave, where they weren't impressive. I think your question is very valid. But they've had a tough game against Vincent's, where Vincent's had to win or they were out. They had a game against Jews where they put up a score of 5-18, so that's fairly impressive. But against Crave, you know, and of all teams to meet in a knockout championship match in Dunnycarney and Parnell Park, Crave is one that you don't want the other end of the field. Crave gave them enough of it and led from, you know, from almost start to about the 50th minute. But I had a look back at the tape, and again, you know, people stand up when needed. Chris Crummy going down the back straight that even got 3 points in a row, Declan, around the 45th to the 52nd or 3rd minute before Lucan got the goal. So they weren't impressive overall, but still, you know, playing against Crave Kieran, you know, to a park, you're not going to beat them in a knockout game by very much. On the other side of that then, you had Nafina, who actually met Crave Kieran in a round robin. And Nafina, unfortunately, and I think this may be the telling point on Sunday and tomorrow, is that their round robin games were against my own Ballinteer, Whitehall, and they beat Crave Kieran very well in the round robin. So they didn't get any tough games in that. And then they did have a tough game against Jews, and anybody that was at the game or has watched it, like, Jews got a tremendous chance to actually put them out before it went to extra time. They have some tremendous forwards. You know, the two Curry brothers, and you know, and sure, Donald Burke, you know, he's been putting up cricket scores for Dublin all year. They weren't impressive on the day against Jude's, neither were Lucan, but I do think that Lucan have had the harder games up to this, and we'll see what happens on Sunday.
And of course, as I said, Nafina did win the Division 1 of the league, which does breed a certain amount of confidence going into a championship, although, as we well know, league and championship are poles apart. But the key battles in this game, Sean, if you're a manager of either side in this looking in, where are the key battles? Where is this game going to be won and lost?
Well, I think, Declan, there's a couple of key battles, but I'm a great believer in winning of primary possession, particularly in a knockout championship game. From probably the 35th to the 55th minute, which is 20 minutes of the second half when the game is in the melting pot, I just think that there's a huge I think that Lucan are probably more than likely to win more primary possession in their own half-forward line than what the Fianna will do in their half-forward line. I believe both of them are, you know, with Liam Rush and Peter Feeney in the Fianna half-back line, I think they're quite capable of winning a lot of primary possession in their own half-back line. I also think the two McCaffreys from Lucan are quite capable of winning it there. So I do believe that, that the primary objective will be to win primary possession from the opponent's puckouts. That will be the key area. I think that Na Fianna will have to have a certainly a big plan for Paul Crummy and Kieran Dowland. Definitely if they don't, as I said, they put up five goals against Jude's earlier in the championship. So they're quite capable if they're given a bit of space of doing that. And from a Lucan perspective, I mean, if they leave AJ Murphy and the Curry brothers and maybe even Shane Barrett maybe in the forwards as well, or he may revert to halfback, I'm not sure. But if they give them space, there's no doubt in my mind that the Na Fianna forwards have the best wrists and will have on show. But if they're starved of possession, you know, it's probably... So they're the three key battle areas as I see them.
Na Fianna are quite unique in this championship. Football and hurling, Sean, in the semi-finals, because they're the only team left in both codes from north of the river. So, the burning question is, are we going to have a north side team in a Dublin County final for 2021, or can the Sars book their place in the final? Call it.
Well, I thought you might let me sit in the fence there. You're talking.
That's all. That's why you're here, Sean. That's why you're the number one analyst.
Yeah, I think that probably Na Fianna have the better hurlers. I think that Lucan are... I've said previously on the show that Lucan this year, I'm first impressed with their conditioning. I think there'll be a huge physical battle. You and me, when we meet, and just met, it's lashing rain. So, you know, the ground is going to be softer. I just think it's going to suit Lucan. And if I'm really pushed, and I know you will, so I better answer your question properly, I'll go for Lucan by 2 points.
Lucan by 2 points, that's the verdict of Sean Lane. So no north side participation in the Dublin County Finals for 2021. It'd be interesting to hear what you, the listeners, have to think about that. Do you agree with Sean, or do you disagree? Anyway, we're going to move on to the second game, which is an absolute blockbuster at county headquarters at 4:15 tomorrow afternoon. Coola, the defending champions, once again putting their title on the line against Kilmacud Crokes. These two sides, of course, have already met in this year's championship. That was in the very first game, Crokes coming through. But the champions, Coola, they're doing what champions do, getting better all the time as this competition progresses, as they showed in their quarter-final victory over Ballyboden and St. Enda's. Let's talk about the two teams in depth, starting with Coola. Have you been impressed with the way that they have been improving in this year's championship after a rocky enough group stages, Sean?
There's no doubt. The first day out against Crokes, they were poor. And I think I said previously that having looked at the team sheet, I wasn't surprised they were missing an awful lot. If you want a north side dimension, if Coola win the match today, Johnny Toomey is the manager. He won a senior championship with O'Toole's in 1983. So there's your north side dimension for the final. But in seriousness, the last...
Was that with the power of Google now, or did you know that?
No, I knew. We were in the semi-final ourselves on the far side by Bowden. But the point I'm going to make on this, and it's not dissimilar to the previous game, is that Coola's last two games, Declan, the last day went to extra time and they just got over the line 127-28 against Bowden. The match before that, they were behind going into the last 10 minutes and they had to score the last 4 points against the Bridges team, who we all know have been improving. And they were one of my tips for that at the start of the year, that they could go all the way this year. They definitely are improving. They're getting players back. I saw Con O'Callaghan the last day definitely improved from the previous day. If Con can improve a little bit more, that's a huge dimension. Mark Shute was standing on the touchline in front of me the last day. Will he play the next day? I don't know. The one thing that Coola will have to do is when you look down at the team sheet for Crokes, you have Considine and Ronan Hayes probably playing a two-man inside forward line. Coola will need to know who's going picking up. I'm assuming Keane O'Callaghan will pick up one. I'm not too sure Simon Timlin, and they've unearthed this very, very good young player in Michael Conroy. You know, whichever one of them is going to be picking up the other one is going to need to be on their game.
And what about on the other side of it then, Crokes, who have been fairly comfortable all the way through? I saw the quarter-final defeat of Oliver Plunkett's own Rue. A little bit sluggish starting off, but once they found their gear, they moved up through them fairly effortlessly and recorded a comfortable win. Is it a little bit of a worry, Sean, to them that perhaps they haven't received that stiff test that Coola have on the other side of it, and how they will react to that if and when, which it will be, presented to them on Sunday?
Yeah, no, that's the key question. The round robins, they beat a half a Coola team, they beat Thomas Davis's, they beat Bridget's, haven't gone behind and beat them comprehensively, and then they draw Plunkett's. You know, and no disrespect, we've said in the show before that Plunkett's have been improving, so they haven't got huge games where the game was in the melting pot. What they have had with those games, though, they were able to breed their new young guns of Dara Purcell, Paddy Lenehan, Kino Kozik. So that's a huge thing. But there's huge experience in this Crokes team as well. You only have to look at the Bill O'Carroll, the Keane McGowans, the Considine and Ron Hayes previously made. But you've Fergal Wheatley, Lorcan McMullen, Oisín O'Rourke, you know, you've Quaylon Conway. Like, they're you know, they've, not unlike Lucan, they've been knocking on the door as well, and they've been beaten in a couple of county finals under Ollie Baker and Anthony Daly in semi-finals. So, you know, they're going to be a hard gun to knock. But again, I think, as in the first game, that the lack of really championship practice prior to this game, in comparison to the two of Coola's last two games against Bridget's and Ballyboden, I just think they'll come up short on Sunday.
Okay, so the Sean Lane verdict is Lucan Sarsfields versus Coola for the 2021 go-ahead Dublin Senior Hurling Championship Final. Certainly looking forward to two great games at Parnell Park tomorrow afternoon. 1:30 and 3:45 are the throw-in times. Well, the Senior B Championship has also reached the penultimate stage of the competition. Both semi-finals are down for decision this weekend at O'Toole Park in Crumlin. This afternoon, Clontarf take on Kilmacud Crokes, while tomorrow afternoon at the same venue, Ballyboden St Enda's will be taking on Castleknock. Great to see Clontarf and Castleknock making the strides in the hurling against the established teams that they will be playing in Crokes and Ballyboden over the course of the weekend in this particular competition, Sean.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I saw Clontarf's, you know, they were beating O'Toole's the last day, I think it was 4-11 to 5 points at half time. There's some fantastic young hurlers there, and they've had a couple of great minor teams. Paddy Smith, as we all know from county perspective, is out there. 2012, not a long time ago, but Kilmacud Crokes reached both Senior A and Senior B finals. They were beaten in the B final that day by Ballyboden. I expect Crokes, with all of the young players, they've won three of the last Minor A championships. I expect them, there'll be five or six of them will fare out in the senior team, but there's still another 30 of them somewhere around Clashstone and you know, Benillas and places like that. So I expect Crokes to win that one. The other one will be more interesting, with Kieran Kilkenny back playing with Castleknock, which I think is great to see, and Ballyboden. But I kind of will go with the bigger club there again. I think Ballyboden will get across the line, and it'll be a repeat of the Senior B final of 2012 with probably a different result. I think Crokes will probably win the Senior B this year.
Well, Sean, just to finish on a general question, you're a volunteer St John's club, man. It's a dual club, of course. And I'm thinking at the moment of particularly Luke and Sarsfields, and the sense of great excitement there is out there at the moment with both teams in the semi-finals of their respective championships. Well done, it must be said, to the footballers on beating the county champions Ballymun Kickhams last week. But from a club point of view, that must be just absolutely fantastic, and the buzz for the whole area and the boost that it gives everyone as well.
Absolutely, and you know, we're not a rural club like Lucan, but having said that, we are on the outskirts of the city, as most GA clubs are now. This is a huge lift for Lucan, if they could get to two finals. And to go back to the football, and I know I'm here to analyse hurling, but they were playing the county champions, they were ahead, they got caught, and you'd kind of expect that, look, Ballymun will kick on now, but they didn't, and Lucan got the last score of the game to come out winners. So on a football front, I think it's fantastic for them. On a hurling front, they're probably been more successful in getting to finals and semi-finals. You know, the hurlers will want to move on this year and push it all the way. And look, is there a formula for them? Perhaps if they get over Nafina and Crokes get over Coola, you know, Lucan may win the championship. I'd find it hard to see Lucan beating Coola in a championship, particularly if Lucan have a really hard game against Crokes and come out the other side of it. But good luck to all teams, Declan, the weekend, Senior A and Senior B.
Well, absolutely. And if any team proves the adage, first you don't succeed, try and try again, it certainly is a team like Lucan. Sean, look forward to meeting you in Parnell Park tomorrow afternoon for what we know will be two fantastic games of hurling.
Time to turn our attention now to the NFL, and it's the one and only Stephen O'Brien. Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
How are you, Reggie? What's going on?
Go on, the Packers. Looking good, buddy. 13-1 you gave us last week for outright winner, and they're continuing to shock the league with their 6th win in a row.
There you go. You see, look, I wasn't just being mindlessly biased because some texter asked, you know, who do you think is going to win? I'm like, the Packers. But yeah, look, they're dominant, Reggie. This was a statement game. Look, the Packers have been kind of... they brought the team back. They brought Aaron Rodgers back at least for one more year. You know, you brought it up maybe last week or a couple of weeks ago about, is this the last dance? Is this, you know, his last time there? And potentially it is. And they really put it on tape. Look, this is a team who, you know, went down to a shocking loss in week one. And they're the only team, I think, in NFL history to go 7 straight after being beaten by, you know, 30 plus points in week one. So, you know, that really looks like a bit of a brain fart game, to be honest. But they went up against the Arizona Cardinals on a short week because it's Thursday night football. This is where most players pick up injuries, and they did because their bodies are beaten up and they're knackered. They go out west to Arizona to the 7-0 Cardinals team, and they have all the weapons in the world, Reggie. I mean, they're flying high. Everyone's going on about how great they were. You know, always being brought on podcasts and shows and asked, like, oh, how are the Packers even going to stack up against this team? Mm. And, you know, I was sort of like, look, they shouldn't on paper, and they do bad when they go out west. But, you know, don't write them off because Matt LaFleur, the head coach, is very clever at designing ways to make it work. And this is a team, Reg, I mean, they're, you know, the Packers, they've been banged up this season big time. They don't have any pass rushers. Za'Darius Smith now, who's due to come back, he's like an all-pro pro bowler. He's been out. Preston Smith got injured and he was out even though he was back for that game. Jair Alexander, he's an all-pro cornerback, best cornerback in the league. He's out. Their O-line has been banged up because their left tackle is out. And not only that, Reg, Devontae Adams, the best wide receiver in NFL, he was out because he caught COVID, so he couldn't go. And then the number 2 wide receiver was a close contact, wasn't vaccinated, so he couldn't go. So everyone's sort of thinking, look, this Packers team are going to get absolutely embarrassed. They go out and they really give it to the Cardinals. And now they're the number 1 team in the NFL by record. So if that doesn't show a statement game, not only that, Reg, and you know this about contact sports, you pick up injuries all the time, and the Packers did that with their tight end, Robert Tonyan, who's done for the season. However, Za'Darius Smith's coming back, Devontae Adams is coming back, left tackle David Bakhtiari is coming back. So they're getting back players, and they're still due a bye week. So they're definitely the team to beat. The real question for me, Reg, is Matt LaFleur, their head coach, still isn't getting the plaudits that he deserves as being one of the best coaches. Mm. It's like having Ronaldo on United and then them winning and them not giving Ole Gunnar Solskjaer his props. Now, that's, we know that for United, the opposite is true, right? Yeah. But for the Packers, Matt LaFleur, they just look at Aaron Rodgers and they go, oh, well, you've got Aaron Rodgers. Of course, he's going to win loads of games. But he's the most winningest coach, which is a word.
Yeah.
In NFL history, through 40 games. So he's most successful coach ever through 40 games, and you can't deny that. And if you look at the game, Reg, and I'll finish now because I get too passionate about the Packers. but when you look at it, Rodgers barely threw the ball past 10 yards against the Cardinals. They ran the ball, they ran it well. But if you look at the stat-wise, if you look at the running backs, they weren't world beaters. You know, they didn't sort of break all the records. In fact, Randall Cobb, the wide receiver who scored the touchdowns, had 15 yards but 2 touchdowns on the night. So that's just really effective passing and it's really effective play calling. And they still don't even consider him for coach of the year, but they have to after that game. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Well, while Matt LaFleur is being considered for coach of the year, it's a bit more difficult down the other end of the table. They've brought in a recent ruling with the NFL that means that in-season firings of coaches are more likely. What's that all about?
Yeah, you see, the way it used to work up until they just tweeted there was that you couldn't interview coaches till after the season was over. And also, you can't interview coaches that are on playoff teams. So what that sets up is, and we talk about it every year, don't we? It's called Black Monday. So the last Sunday of the NFL season, that Monday, everyone gets the cardboard box and the photos of their kids and they get sent out the door packing. And that's what happens. So a bad team will hold on to a bad coach because it never usually works out, apart from the Packers when they fired Mike McCarthy and then they got Matt LaFleur after Joe Philbin. But anyway, it never usually works out, Reg. You know, when you have this coach that's kicked out mid-season and then you just limp on for the rest of the season. You know, because coaches look at that team then and go, oh, well, they don't really care about winning. or player morale. They just want to make changes, and that's not good. Whereas this time now, what they can do is for the last 2 weeks of the season, you can actually interview assistant coaches, even if they're still playing on different teams. So that's going to open it up completely now. So if you look at teams like the Bears or the Giants or, you know, the Panthers, look at these teams. What they might do then is they might shaft their coaches mid-season, limp on, and then start getting all these interviews in 2 weeks before and have their new head coach almost locked down before the season is over. Whereas before, they were in a rush to fire them on the Monday and then interview as many people as they can. Also, there's a guy called Eric Bieniemy who is with the Kansas City Chiefs. Mm. They've always found their way into the playoffs. They won't probably this year. But he always lost out, Reg. He was a guy who was seen as massive head coaching potential, but he could never interview for anybody. And again, he did interview for people. They'd already fired their coaches on Black Monday. They've already sort of freaked out that if they don't get the guy they liked in that first interview in and waited for Bieniemy to finish, which is the Super Bowl, by the way, well, then they'd miss out. And then if they don't get him, well, then they're goosed then for next season. So every time he came in to interview, they kind of just moved on. So this is interesting now that they might start firing their coaches a little bit earlier now, because then they can gear up for those last 2 weeks of the season, even for the likes of Eric Bieniemy, get him settled in. The only question I would ask, Reg, is that how distracted is a coach going to be who's going to the playoffs, who knows he has a head coaching job elsewhere, and his mind is probably set on that? I don't know if that's a thing or it's just a media trope, but it's something to consider.
Absolutely. Interesting stuff. Okay. Kansas are having their woes. $500 million contract they gave Patrick Mahomes in 2020, but he had the worst game of his career last week. Is it time for Kansas to panic?
A little bit. I mean, look, the thing is you have Colin Kaepernick, right? And he was a guy who ran all over the Packers for forever. And they sort of figure out these triple threat quarterbacks because if you manage to contain them, they tend to not be good passers. Now, let me just preface this by saying Patrick Mahomes is unbelievable. The guy is superhuman and still is superhuman. However, they seem to have found a way, Reg, to contain him. Because it's kind of counterintuitive, right? What they've figured out is, and the blueprint was set by the Bucs in the Super Bowl loss, is that you think with a superstar quarterback like Patrick Mahomes, who can run around everywhere, can pick a pass, can bomb the ball downfield, just keep annoying him, keep pressuring him, keep blitzing him, and make him scramble around the place and try to put him to ground. But what they figured out about Patrick Mahomes was, is don't do that. So don't blitz him, send four, and then drop everybody into coverage. And then what happens is, you see, the thing is, once you blitz him and pressure him, he'll evade you, and then he'll find the guy that you're after opening up a hole on your defense with by bringing that extra man to try get him. So what you do is, if you can contain him, bring pressure with four, and just drop everybody into coverage and man mark, he finds it very difficult to try pick out a player then, because everybody else is covered. But I would say, and I would preface that by, teams have also tried that with great success, including, as you said, last week. It was his worst game as a pro ever. And then the Bills did it, the Titans did it, but then the Eagles tried to do that, and then they got absolutely pasted. So it doesn't always work. You need to be a good unit who's used to Patrick Mahomes. On top of that, Reg, they tried to shore up his O-line because he got absolutely spanked in the Super Bowl. He got put to ground so many times and he couldn't get the ball off. So they bolstered their O-line and it still isn't great. And then to do that, they sort of were deficient on defense and they couldn't bolster that. They were punching above their weight last year. They ended up being terrible. So now Patrick Mahomes used to be able to sort of, like in the playoffs 2 years ago, he came back after the Texans went up 21-0. He's not able to do that lately because he's under so much pressure. And he says himself he needs to work on his fundamentals. So I don't think it's time to hit the panic button yet, but it's super concerning. And it doesn't actually look like they're on trend to even make the playoffs this year, which is pretty incredible with a Patrick Mahomes player. As you say, you've paid him $503 million in a contract and you can't make the playoffs. It's shocking stuff.
Terrifying figures and numbers of dollars, no question about it. Okay, the Texans, Deshaun Watson, obviously all the litany of things going on around legal cases and everything else. There's chat that the Texans might be looking for a trade of him before the deadline closes on the 2nd of November. Is there anybody interested or is he too risky a prospect?
We've spoken about this before, haven't we, Reds? Like, I mean, you know, Wayne Rooney went and did what he did, and he bangs in a couple of goals, and you're like, ah, he's grand. You know, and that's the same with Deshaun Watson. He's 22 sexual misconduct allegations, 10 criminal cases open, but they haven't, they're all allegations, I will say, right? So they haven't actually got a friend. So much so, the Texans don't feel like they can play him for moral reasons, and they also think if they start playing him, that the commissioner can turn around and put him on what's called an exempt list, so he can sort of stop him from playing anyway. And it's like having a car, like a Ferrari, in the front yard. You don't know if the engine's going to work, and you want to sell it for full price, but you know if you start and it doesn't work, all the price drops from it. And that's kind of what's happening with the Texans here. They're scared to play him in case he gets put on that list. Now, it came out during the week that he's not going to be exempted by the commissioner because it's not a violent crime that he's up against, which I don't know how they come out with that if there's 22 sexual misconduct things. You know, where do you see the violence there? You know, I see massive violence if there's that allegation against him, although there are still allegations. But look, the Dolphins are after him. The Panthers have inquired about him, but they have to move him before November 2nd. And what the Texans are asking for is like a billion first-round picks plus most of the other team's roster for him. You know, they're still treating him like a high-value commodity. But they don't know, Reds, this is what's happening. They don't know if they can trade him, because if they do and they put him in the starting lineup, and he has a no-trade clause as well, by the way. He says he only wants to go to the Dolphins. I mean, Bakers can't be choosers, but here you go. But if he goes to the Dolphins and they do trade for him and they put him on the active roster, Roger Goodell could easily turn around and go, nope, you can't play him, he's exempt. And now you're after paying like a king's ransom for him and you can't even use him. But yeah, there's talk out there, Reds, that the deal's done for the Dolphins. And like we always say, if he starts playing and throwing touchdowns and all that type of stuff, yeah, it's amazing the moral stuff people forget, you know.
Okay. Right, it's time for Araka, if you want to give me that for this week.
Sure thing. 6-1. San Fran 49ers against the Bears. They're 3.5 favourites there, so I like going for the small odds. Tennessee Titans coming up against the Indianapolis Colts. They put a brilliant game together last week, and they're actually the underdogs in this game, so it's plus 2.5. So even if they lose, you know, it's not the end of the world, although it's a small spread. And then the LA Rams to beat the Houston Texans. Then that's a massive spread of minus 15.5. They just didn't get there last week first against the Lions, so I'm hoping that they'll get there this week.
Okay, it's time for football now, and a wonderful win during the week for the Ireland women's team, 2-1 in Helsinki. We're going to be talking to Aaron Clark in just a moment, but first of all, let's hear him talking to Vera Powell.
In terms of the goal, I know it was a free kick, but before the goal, you'd actually started the game very well.
Yeah.
On the front foot, pushing forward and pushing players up, and you can see even the two wing backs getting up and putting a lot of pressure on them.
Yeah. We were actually dominating the first 15 minutes, and I need to see in the video where the turnaround was, because we didn't play differently, but their pressure became bigger and bigger and bigger. Their number 10 was moving around, the 17 came in, the 10 came on the left side, and that gave us some problems, but it shouldn't bring that pressure. We need to see that, but the fact that they get under pressure and then not collapsing or not making mistakes anymore, that is amazing.
In terms of the game itself, like Thursday you'd be disappointed, yes it's a 1-0 loss, but coming into today you could see that the players they've learned from these sort of games they played in recent weeks, because there's been times where maybe you just decide to drop too deep and you invite them on, and then you look at today late on in particular, the players are sort of, you can hear them screaming, telling their teammates to get up, get further forward, just to put that little bit of extra pressure on, just so they're trying to relieve anything, whereas in previous maybe they might have set back that little bit more and invited Finland to sort of come and really put the screw in.
Yeah, what we definitely learned from the games against a higher opposition is get first behind the opponent and as a unit press forward, and indeed going forward. We need to improve with the ball. We need to, in our attack, we need to keep the ball better under pressure, but that is the next step.
In terms of performances, I know you probably won't want to single out individuals, but the likes of Denise O'Sullivan was superb tonight. Heather Payne was brilliant. A lot of good individual displays as well as a superb team display.
Yeah, but don't forget that whole back line, eh? Under that pressure and staying on your feet and every time having the guts to go into the duel, because it's on the edge. And they hardly made any fouls. I don't know the stats, but I think Jamie, that was unfortunate, her yellow card. I don't think that was meant to be that bad for a yellow card, but we need to see. I need to see that on the video. But overall, they were always dangerous from set pieces, and they were always dangerous from high balls. And the fact that whole back line kept going and kept fighting with Jamie and Megan in front of them at the end and battling their way through and closing all the gaps, that is fantastic.
Yeah, I'm joined now by Aaron Clark. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Not too bad. So even better after Tuesday night.
I can imagine. It was a hell of a performance. I mean, the Swedish game was, you know, there was a lot of praise for the team after that, going up against a team of the quality of Sweden. But this one was one that, you know, was equally as difficult away from home in Helsinki, and one that they really did need to get the result in to try and jump ahead of Finland. And no easy ask, but a great performance.
Yeah, like I spoke to Vera the day before the game at the pre-match press conference, and she started didn't want to get drawn into whether it was a must-win game or a must-not-lose game. And you could see the nerves and the tension was there. So it was sort of a case of you were looking at it as if it was going to be a difficult task. But the way they started the game, they came out, pressed very highly, pushed the finish back very early on. And, you know, they got their just rewards in the 10th minute with the opening goal from Heather Payne, from Megan Connolly after Heather Payne won a dangerous free kick on the edge of the box. And you could see the three players standing over Heather, Megan, Lucy and Katie. You could see who was going to take it. And thankfully, Megan Connolly put it in the back of the net. But, you know, as Vera was saying, at times they were out there looking in defence. The defence stood up tall. Finland had an opportunity in the 33rd minute with a free header, but it went wide. In the first half in particular, Courtney Brosnan wasn't really tested majorly. You know, she made the one save when the player was caught offside. But if you look at when their goal came, it came from an opportunity where Katie McCabe had just been fouled, and the player who actually fouled Katie McCabe was the player who actually scored the goal. They broke down that flank and got a lovely ball into the box, and it was finished nicely. Mm. Normally you'd expect Ireland to sort of go into a little bit of a shell after that,
yeah,
you know, and sort of sit back, but they didn't. And that was the most thing that impressed me most. They went for it then off the back of it. You know, a great run from Heather Payne down the right flank. She was superb all night. Her ball into the box. Keeper, unfortunately, didn't hold. And Denise O'Sullivan wasn't gonna make any mistake from so close home. You know, it was one of them. And when you take the lead again, you're living dangerous at the back, trying not to concede. But we looked dangerous going forward. Yeah. Katie McCabe was superb with, you know, her runs. She broke down the left flank a couple of times. Once she shot wide at the far post. Another time, it ended up with Anya O'Gorman shooting wide from the edge of the box. So there was lots of positives. And then you look at, in particular, as Vera was saying about the defence, Niamh Fahey clearing the ball off the line deep in the normal time, and then Heather Payne in the 91st minute with a slight tackle. If that goes wrong, it's a penalty, and then we're looking at a different result. But massive performance from every player on the pitch. I think it was, as you say, it was one that we needed to get ahead of Finland, because there's no doubt that Finland were definitely the favourites for second place. They've qualified for a lot of major tournaments. We haven't. But we've a lot of players in that squad who've played underage competitions. Like, there's a lot of that Ireland team would have played in the 2010 World Cup where they got to the quarterfinals. The likes of Katie McCabe would have played in the European Championships underage. So there's lots of experience there. And it was a result that you left Helsinki thinking, amazing, what a result. You know, but the biggest thing now is that there's two massive games next month, Slovakia at home on the 25th and then Georgia home on the 30th, where 6 points is a must out of them to continue to build momentum.
Yeah, absolutely. And it looks like a team that are growing in that momentum and growing in confidence as you see them play. They don't seem to fear anybody, and that's a great way to be.
Like, you look at the back of the Sweden, at the end of the Sweden game, you know, last 10 minutes they're putting the pressure on Sweden. Sweden end up making a change to sort of push on Ireland in terms of to stop what Ireland are trying to do. So that just shows the respect they're getting off these sort of teams. And you're right, they played with a lot of no fear in the Finland game, which was great to see. And they really went at them, and they went to show that they're capable of competing with these. So it's like, maybe you look back at the run of defeats, they were all against top sides. Whereas now you look at what's going on, and, you know, getting that win against Finland, it can only breed massive confidence going into the remainder of the campaign. And it's the most important thing is that the momentum, they take that momentum on and they push on. Thankfully, they only have like 4 weeks between camps, so it's not a long time of club action. So they will be back with each other quite soon to try and build on that.
And are they getting much of that time together to build that sort of team spirit and everything else? They do seem to be quite a close bunch, but you would wonder if they're managing to get enough time together.
It's a tough one. Mm. It's a tough one, you know, because they when they go into camp, like you look at when they went into camp for the last one, they would have went in on the Sunday and then they're playing on the Thursday. But you have players who would have played on the Sunday as well, and the likes of America with Denise O'Sullivan and Diane Caldwell, Heather Payne, Roman McLaughlin. So players would have been only flying in on the Monday. Then you're sort of having to adjust your training schedules around that. So they may not have really got an awful lot of training sessions before Sweden. It was more the time in between Sweden and Finland where they would have had more time to work on things. But it looks as though Vera has set her stall out in terms of how she wants to play with her formation. And it only seems to be little tweaks in between each game to how they are doing things. So a lot of what she's doing is similar week in, week out. Like the five at the back is something that she's had for a while. A lot of the players in the team are playing the games week in, week out. So she's not making a lot of changes. So her starting 11 bar one or two is normally the exact same. So there would be a bit of cohesion in between them. You'd always like a little bit more time to work with your players, but unfortunately, international level, it's not always available.
And it's Slovakia next, is that correct?
Yeah, Slovakia next on the 25th of November. Best thing there is that there'll be no crowd restrictions at the moment, so hopefully we get a full Talos Stadium for both Slovakia and Georgia on the 30th, because we need to come away with 6 points and we need to make sure that we're making Talos a boisterous, a really tough place to come for teams. And they won't be any easy tasks, Slovakia. They've improved massively in the last couple of years, so you know, it'll be a game that Ireland won't take lightly.
Absolutely. Well, it's a fantastic performance by them. We're delighted to see them doing so well. And I think it's really great the way the Irish public have gotten behind this team, and we really want to push them forward. So, Aaron, brilliant talking to you. Thanks for that clip with Vera. Really interesting stuff. We'll catch up with you again very soon, hopefully.
No problem at all. Have a lovely day.
You too. That's Aaron Clark there giving us all of his thoughts on that wonderful win for the ladies team during the week. Okay, it was a good night as well for Shamrock Rovers last night, managing to win their second title in a row. And Declan Drake caught up with Stephen Bradley after the game.
And consistency in League of Ireland clubs is often a problem, trying to maintain the group, and clubs rotate so many different players, but not a position that you're in next season because you've got so many players under contract. Of course you're going to think about adding to it to strengthen it even more.
Yeah, we'll hope to keep the group as it is together next year and add one or two to it. We don't want much change. The last few years we've had a bit of change with selling players and everything that comes with that, so we don't want too much change. We want to stay together and build on that.
And finally for you as a manager, looking back at it now, back-to-back league titles and an FAI Cup in 3 seasons, it just doesn't get any better than that at the moment.
No, it doesn't. Look, you have to enjoy these moments. Stephen Kenny texted me earlier on and said make sure you enjoy the evening because they're special evenings, and he's right. Football can take you to low places and dark places, but can also take you to the highest peaks, and tonight is one of them.
Thanks for listening to Dublin Stock and Sport on Sunshine 106.8 from myself, Ken, and Reggie. Have a good weekend.